You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org. This is a live recording from the Roger Smith Cookbook Conference.
This is Katie Kiefer from the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm sitting in our pop-up studio at the Roger Smith Hotel for the Cookbook Conference with the wonderful Barbara Haber, a food historian extraordinarius.
Katie, you're too much.
No, hardly. I haven't even gotten started yet, Barbara, for God's sake. I know Barbara for many years, although not particularly well, but through her extraordinary reputation, where she started the culinary section of the Schlesinger Library at Harvard University. And Barbara, why don't you just take us through why exactly you felt like putting in a culinary section was not only important from the point of view of just food history, but also a political statement?
Well, I think the Schlesinger Library is essentially a women's history library. That's why it was founded. That's what it was doing, principally. It happened to have a small core of cookbooks and home economics books when I first started there. And those were there kind of accidentally. Another Harvard library that received those books as a donation gave them to the women's library.
Because only women could possibly be interested in cooking.
Because cooking and women's history and what women did, let's put it that way, has traditionally been trivialized. And it seemed to me that food and cooking was a big part of women's history. It wasn't a political part necessarily, but most of the cooking most of the time has been done by women, and I think domestic history is important and interesting, as is political history. So when I got the job at the library, I cut my teeth on women's history. I was there at the right time. I developed the Women's Liberation Collection. I kept up with the scholarship. It was all exciting and new, and great stuff was coming along. And I felt that I had an intellectual framework to absorb domesticity and women's history as well. And I had to be kind of certain about what I was doing when I sort of went all out and was in a position to develop the cookbook collection so that we could add things, we could receive donations and accept them from collectors. And at the same time, I felt that I had to prove that I was on the right track, because there was a lot of agitation in the library that it was changing the mission of the library. It was no longer, you know, why wasn't I interested in women's history? And I had a difficult, if not impossible, time explaining to people that this was women's history. And so I did a lot of programming, and I did a lot of programming that positioned food history as social history. And that when you look at a subject through the lens of food, you get a whole other story. You get other material coming up. And all of that was controversial at the time. And by today's standards, you know, it's of course, you know, but of course.
What I think is interesting about the fact that at the time you got so much pushback from your colleagues is that here was women's studies, you know, proclaiming that actually women were so much more valuable than just being in the domestic role,
right.
And what you were doing was, it must have looked to them as if you were trying to push them back.
Very
into the
retro,
kitchen.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, with that kind of mindset. And for some reason, cooking, especially kitchens and cooking, barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen,
yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know, all of these symbols of the patriarchy. So cooking was like the running dog of the patriarchy. And I was pushing back on that. What do you mean? You know, cooking was the most creative thing that people did, blah, blah, blah.
Well, and also from the management point of view, I mean, when you think about, if you look at old cookbooks, and I have a little collection of my own, mm-hmm. but you read some of the menus, say, from the New Orleans Times Picayune
sure.
cookbook from, say, the 20s or something like that, and a menu goes on and on and on, right? It'll
yeah.
have five or six different dishes, even for breakfast.
Right.
It'll include eggs and vegetables and two or three different kinds of meats, maybe a fish.
The demand of skills is
yes,
what you're pointing out.
Yes, a huge
out.
Demand
yeah.
of skills in terms of not only producing that food, but also sourcing that food,
right.
Ordering the sufficient quantities.
Handling money
yeah.
and being careful with money. And even beyond that, I'm interested in community cookbooks or charity cookbooks. That is, the books that are produced by churches, synagogues, art institutes, you know, so on, to
Junior
make money.
League.
Right, right.
That's
by groups of volunteer
right? yeah.
women. Now, that goes back to the Civil War, and the women who started these books collecting money for war efforts it was a way for them to get out of their houses, to meet with potential sponsors, to organize the book itself, to collect aphorisms and poetry and all the rest of it. It got them out and about working on a project that had some meaning and a performance that led to funds for worthy causes. Mm-hmm. So they learned a lot about, you know, how to run a business.
Yeah, and how to community organize.
Exactly.
Very interesting.
If you ask the right questions, you can get some really interesting social history.
Absolutely.
From cookbooks.
Oh, yeah. Mm. I mean, just the notes of marginalia and things like that. And to me, reading like the chapter headings, I mean, I have a 1954 or 56 version of The Joy of Cooking, for example, which I think is fascinating reading. And it's something that I go back to and use again and again. It's just a basic primer on things like, you know, how many, you know, tablespoons of butter in a béarnaise sauce or something like that.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with the recipes. They're all very well tested, and it works really well
to this day. I use that book at least once a year for pumpkin pie.
Okay.
I happen to like Irma's recipe for pumpkin pie.
Yeah.
The other thing about the Schlesinger, before we get away from that topic, we got the papers of MFK Fisher, of Julia Child, of Irma Rombauer, and my last act before leaving was to get Elizabeth David's papers, which are there
now.
Yeah. So, you know, if anybody's doing serious work on this subject, you go there.
Yeah, absolutely. What was the name of the book that you published that proved your theory?
Right. You know, I was blithely forging ahead, you know, on instinct, and I knew that I really had to write and prove. And the test I set up for myself was to take a very common chapter in American history and see if I could get a new story out of it by using food as the piece. And I also was interested in combining it with women's history. So I looked at the Civil War. You know, nothing has been more written about in our history than the Civil War.
That's for sure.
And I looked at it through the eyes of women volunteers, both in the North and South, who volunteered as nurses at a time when there was no such profession, when a lot of the military hospitals were they were run by surgeons, and the people who were doing the nursing jobs were recovering soldiers. And the women who came in as volunteers, they were the ones who were writing letters home from dying boys, and had those kinds of motherly duties. And the best of them, and there were some incredibly interesting women, were defying doctor's orders, because this was a time when for breakfast people were eating pork chops and potatoes and drinking whiskey.
Yeah.
And hard liquor was...
Are you saying there's something wrong with that?
I think if you're... If you've been shot in the belly, let's just put it that way. It's not the best
Maybe
thing.
Maybe not the whiskey. Then.
And the women knew that, and they would find milk and eggs. One woman rustled down a herd of cattle and flocks of chickens by foot from the north to get into a military hospital, because she knew those boys needed that kind of sustenance, you know, bland, nourishing food. And so what interested me about the story, how both a prominent southern woman, and a lot of them were childless women, they might have been widows, and they needed something to do. They rolled up their sleeves and they did remarkable things in these field hospitals and all the rest of it. So that was a story that I told there, and I hadn't seen that before.
What's the name of the book?
The book is called From Hardtack to Home Fries.
Oh, of course.
An Uncommon History of American Cooks and Meals. And the most popular chapter, in fact, I'm giving a talk on this subject tomorrow at this conference, was on the FDR... Franklin Roosevelt White House, and why it was that bad food was served there, you know, for the whole 12 years that he was in office. For years, I had come across references to if you're invited to the White House for dinner, be sure you eat first. And I kept seeing that. And one of the Roosevelt sons, in fact, wrote a slew of mysteries. Elliot Roosevelt sat in the White House with his mother as a sleuth, like a Miss Marple.
How hilarious!
And he makes fun of the food. And what I got to the bottom of the story is that Eleanor Roosevelt had hired as her housekeeper a woman who had no professional experience whatsoever. She was a homemaker whose husband lost his job because of the Depression, but she'd had an Austrian mother, a Viennese mother, who taught her how to bake. And she was baking breads and pastries for neighbors in Hyde Park, and that's how she met Eleanor. And when FDR got to be the the governor of New York. She, Eleanor would order up by train, Mrs. Nesbitt, her name was Henrietta Nesbitt, her pastries and all the rest of it. And so the next step when he got to be president was she brought the Nesbitts, Eleanor did, into the White House, because by then they were real friends and she could trust her. Mm-hmm. And it was first the Depression, then the war, and this was a bantam rooster of a woman, if you could use that peculiar image, who was concerned that the White House set the right tone and not be eating high off the hog when everybody else was either poor or out of work or rationed. And she made sure that she used, you know, the odd bits of the animals and all the rest of it.
So she made sure that the White House kitchen reflected the same kitchen as the rest of America.
Yes.
By and large.
Right. Probably worse, you know, because she was not a gifted cook. She, fortunately for me, left behind a cookbook and a memoir. So I got to read her side of the story before I had just read the criticism, including New York Times articles. And, in fact, there's a brand new book out about Churchill, and I came across a reference in that. He had come to America at the beginning of the war because he was so interested in getting Roosevelt to help the Brits. And he stayed at the White House for 3 weeks and said that the food was atrocious. He said, and he described a particular meal as being slimy but good. So I'm going to ask the question, how can you use both of those words in the same sentence?
I don't know, oysters?
Yeah.
Slimy but good.
You're right. You're right. You're so shrewd. Right.
Pudding.
Yes.
But I think we have to draw the line there. Maybe liver. But that's definitely an acquired taste.
I'm going to write you right into my talk for tomorrow. I really am. So, you know, it was so intriguing. You know, why was this woman there? Why was bad food tolerated? And the answer is Eleanor could care less about food. She saw the dining table as a way to get political work done. So yeah. She would bring together people who could move her agenda or the president's agenda. And, you know, her idea of a meal before catching a train would be crackers and milk. Mm-hmm. But she knew that if she had visitors, and they had a lot of visitors, she would send them off with a basket of fried chicken and all the trimming. She understood that other people, you know, thought food was important. She did not happen to think so. But what she knew, by hiring this woman, she could leave and she would know that meals would be served on time and regularly, and the house was well run. Yeah. And so, in other words, she trusted her, and Mrs. Nesbitt loved Eleanor Roosevelt and would do anything for her.
Well, I'm going to come and hear that talk.
Okay.
And we should wrap it up now. Barbara Haber, the wonderful food historian, thanks so much for joining me in the studio today.
And it's just lovely to spend time with you, Katie.
Thank you, and I hope the next time you pass through New York, you'll come to the studios at Roberta's, and we'll do a longer show.
Okay, we'll be
about
in touch.
About food politics, actually. I'd love to talk to you about politics.
Sure, okay. I do pop up in New York from time to time.
Okay. Thanks so much, Barbara.
Sure.
That's it for today.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, iTunes, and Stitcher for more. Visit our website, heritageradionetwork.org, for all of our 30-plus weekly podcasts. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.